Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our guests today, Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Jonathan Hasid as well from Iowa State University, where he's Associate Professor of Political Science. Jonathan, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
Coming up just a little bit later, Sarah and Jonathan's analysis of Biden's new vaccine mandate announced last week. Also, some new poll numbers out from Quinnipiac yesterday, dropping poll numbers for President Biden. A federal judge blocking that ban on Iowa's school mask mandates. We'll talk about that. Also, Governor Reynolds calling a special legislative session to address redistricting. Those to come. But first, the top political news overnight, or rather in the evening, yesterday, Gavin Newsom elected to governor in 2018 of California by a wide margin. Yesterday, 3 years later, facing a recall election, Republicans who led the charge saying voters were dissatisfied with his handling of the pandemic, also homelessness in California, other issues. The governor, Newsom, and fellow Democrats saying the recall was little more than a power grab by disgruntled Trump extremists. Well, yesterday, Governor Newsom easily survived that recall election. More than two-thirds of California voters said no to the recall of Newsom. Jonathan Hasid, let's start with you. What are your takeaways from this result?
Well, you know, it's not really clear how much we can take as a national, from in terms of national politics from this one result. Obviously, California is an extremely blue state that's gotten more blue over time. You know, Biden won very handily in California. And so in that sense, it's not that surprising that a Democratic governor would win a recall in a heavily Democratic state. But, you know, if we do want to look for national takeaways, I think one thing that's clear is that, you know, in places like California and perhaps elsewhere, Trumpism does not appeal to huge sections of the electorate. Larry Elder, the Republican frontrunner, was unabashedly pro-Trump and anti-vaccine mandate and anti-mask mandate. And, you know, those policies didn't seem to resonate in California. And so, you know, the GOP has lost ground over many decades now in the state. And it seems like they're turning toward this kind of loud, bombastic style as a model. And at least what this election shows us is that that was not an effective thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, what do you think this anti-Trump strategy of the Newsom campaign against the yes vote, what do you think that means possibly for a strategy for Democrats and maybe in 2022 and beyond?
Well, I think it was fairly effective in California because 7 in 10 people in California are in favor of mask mandates. So in terms of emphasizing the governor's handling, of the COVID crisis, I think that, helped to get people out to vote. And in places like Orange County, the governor did really well. So you didn't see sort of gains that Democrats have made in the suburbs of places like Orange County were solidified in this particular vote. So I think it was a good strategy overall in terms of emphasizing those policies and what the governor has done to address them.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, each state sets its own hurdles for when a governor may be recalled. California has had a few of these, one successful, notable one in recent history. Both Joe Biden, President Biden, and Vice President Kamala Harris went to California to campaign for the no vote. This is a really strange system, I guess, in California, when you could have had, by a simple majority, the governor recalled and then put in his place to serve as governor, someone who would have had less than 10% of the vote in this case, right?
It is very odd. It's a, I was actually living in California during the last recall, the successful one in 2003 of Gray Davis, and there's a real circus-like atmosphere surrounding this process. The you know, this is a legacy of the progressive era of American politics around the turn of the 20th century. The idea was at the time California was basically run by railroad barons, including people like Leland Stanford, who gave his namesake through his son to Stanford University. And voters at the time were really frustrated with the fact that they had felt that they had no say in national and in state politics. So they, among other things, passed this referendum system, but it wasn't, it doesn't, as you pointed out, it's not terribly well designed, right? The governor can, the sitting governor can lose and then be replaced by someone wildly unpopular if there's a huge number of candidates to replace him or her, which makes it in a certain way fundamentally undemocratic. The recall and initiative systems in California have also essentially been taken over by big business. And so this was a policy solution to a problem of big business domination that has, in a sense, been turned on its head over the years and now benefits some of the very forces that it was designed more than 100 years ago to prevent.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, are political analysts on this Wednesday politics edition of River to River. Well, the fast-spreading Delta variant sparking a new wave of sickness and death. When I look at the New York Times data this morning, nearly 2,000 per day dying across the country. Washington Post reporting now that we've reached a point where one in 500 Americans have died from this pandemic. An astounding statistic, one in 500. Joe Biden, a president who ran on promises to get control of the pandemic, last week he announced policies requiring most federal employees to get COVID-19 vaccinations, pushing large employers to have their workers inoculated or tested weekly. Here he is in the last week, September 9th address to the nation, outlining this vaccine mandate for federal workers, contractors, major private employers, educators participating in federal Head Start program. Biden said it's his job to protect the American people.
The Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week. Some of the biggest companies are already requiring this. United Airlines, Disney, Tyson's Food, and even Fox News. The bottom line, we're going to protect vaccinated workers from unvaccinated coworkers. We're going to reduce the spread of COVID-19 by increasing the share of the workforce that is vaccinated in businesses all across America.
Okay, Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida fired back at the president's vaccine rules here. Here he is speaking in Florida on September 10th, saying President Biden is acting outside the bounds of the Constitution.
When you have a president like Biden issuing unconstitutional edicts against the American people, we have a responsibility to stand up for the Constitution and to fight back. This order would result potentially in millions of Americans losing their jobs. I think we should be protecting people's jobs, not trying to kick people out of work right now.
Okay. Sarah, You take the first crack at this on the comments we just heard and why the president took this step and why now?
Well, I think we're going to talk about the survey data later, but you'll see in that data, I think, that even among Democrats, there was some dissatisfaction about Biden's handling of the COVID situation. So I think partly this is a response, you know, a lot of people in the Democratic Party were expecting something like this to happen and to happen more quickly, honestly. so we know from a lot of studies that have been done that masks are very effective at preventing the spread of COVID because it's an aerosol-based you know, exposure. So it makes sense in terms of matching the policy to the, what we know from the scientific studies. On the question of constitutionality, I mean, it's not correct to say that it's unconstitutional. In 1905, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Jacobson versus Massachusetts that local authorities could mandate vaccination on penalty of a fine when they were having a smallpox outbreak. And in the more recent case, South Bay United Pentecostal Church versus Newsom, Chief Justice John Roberts referred to that case. He kind of takes a somewhat middle position in terms of recognizing both local authorities' ability to set policy, but also I think some constitutional scholars have argued that the reference back to that Supreme Court case indicates that that the government does have the right to protect people when we have serious, you know, disease outbreaks.
An outcry over this action from Republican governors. We heard Ron DeSantis of Florida there, but also the same sort of words echoed by our governor, Kim Reynolds, harshly criticizing this announcement. She has urged eligible Iowans to get vaccinated for sure, but has strongly opposed mandating vaccinations. Here are her words in reaction to the president's words. President Biden is taking dangerous and unprecedented steps to insert the federal government even further into our lives while dismissing the ability of Iowans and Americans to make health care decisions for themselves. Reynolds also added that Biden's plan will worsen the state's workforce shortage, limit its economic recovery. Jonathan, react to our governor's words there in reaction to the president's mandate.
I think to echo what Sarah said, the mandate nationally is probably clearly constitutional. There was an additional case in 1922 where the court said, quote, it had settled that it is within the police power of a state to provide for compulsory vaccination. And so, you know, this is political posturing, if you like. There perhaps is some question about whether or not these rulings and this stare decisis applies only to the states or to the federal government. But given the wide mandate offered to OSHA that the Biden administration is going through by the Occupational Safety and Health Act, it seems clear that it's likely to survive. That said, you know, in Iowa, I haven't seen numbers on this, but I'm guessing it's going to be a vaccine mandate, for example, is going to be a lot less popular than it is nationally. Mm-hmm. And so in this sense, it'll be Governor Reynolds playing to her base. She perhaps also has a point. The courts haven't weighed in explicitly on this, that this vaccine mandate power is restricted to states and not federal government. I think it's probably unlikely, given the way, for example, the court recently batted down a challenge to Indiana University's vaccine mandate. They just refused to hear the case. But it's possible she has a point here. In any case, you know, this is probably good politics for her in Iowa to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Sarah, if you can answer this. Is this, when we look at the president's toolbox, how many tools left does he have after taking this one out for increasing vaccination rates? This is what he promised during his campaign, is an end to this pandemic.
Yeah, I think it's not surprising that he's starting with federal employee mandates and contractors that work with federal government, because, yeah, that's where the constitutionality is very clear in terms of what he can do. These other cases do indicate that, you know, states' rights versus federal rights can come into play in some of those situations. But I think it's interesting that if you look at other vaccine mandates beyond the COVID vaccine, some of the reddest states in the America have the strictest vaccine policies. So it's kind of interesting, like places like Mississippi or Alabama have really strict vaccine regulations on other vaccines. So in this way, COVID-19 is a real departure from what the GOP has done in other states, in other places.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, before we go to break in the minute or so that we have before our break, reflect on what this means internationally with the U.S. in the set of Western industrialized societies. We are now dropping in our vaccination rate compared to other developed countries. What's different about us? Why is this happening?
Well, it's the partisan divide. I think we're now last in the G7 among the largest seven industrialized powers in vaccination rates. And we started off near the top. You know, basically, as you know, the numbers show that a lot of this vaccine hesitancy is driven by Republicans. And there's a lot of overlap, in particular with white evangelicals, who are refusing to take the vaccine for one reason or another, in large part, I think, because of what they're hearing on social media and they're hearing on places like talk radio. And so in that sense, you know, it's kind of an international embarrassment for the United States, right? A lot of the vaccine technology was developed here, but Americans are choosing to die, you know, at what Biden calls correctly a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Jonathan Hasid with us of Iowa State University. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa are two able political scientists on this Wednesday edition of River to River. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we do, we'll talk about Biden's newest poll numbers from Quinnipiac University. The first time Biden's job approval has dropped into negative territory since taking office. We'll have our analysts pick it apart when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and Corridor Aesthetics.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's your Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, we'll discuss with our analysts Sarah Mitchell and Jonathan Hasid Monday action by a federal judge blocking our state law that had prohibited schools across the state from requiring mask wearing. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, both in their respective faculty for political science. And let's talk first, though, about a new Quinnipiac University national poll of adults. This released yesterday. Americans' views have evidently dimmed on the way President Biden is handling his job. 42% approving, 50% disapproving. This marks the first time Biden's job approval has dropped into negative territory since taking office. There are a lot of parts to dissect here. Sarah, what would you like to point to when you look at this latest survey?
Well, I think for comparison purposes, his 42% approval here in August of the first year compares to about Bill Clinton's level of 44%, higher than what Trump's level was at 36, and then below Obama's at 53 and George W. Bush's at 56. So kind of, not doing as well, say, as Obama was doing at this point in time. However, I would say it's my impression that both the right and the left media have been very critical with respect to the Afghanistan withdrawal. So it's not surprising to me that you see some erosion even among Democrats in this survey of approval of Biden. So I think it's hard to assess, how long term that's going to hold, because in that same poll, 7 in 10 said it was the right thing to end the war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So the question is, will he bounce back eventually after he gets through this negative media cycle related to that event?
Yeah. Sarah, both you and Jonathan with considerable foreign policy chops in your political science studies. Let's talk about that. Jonathan, perhaps Americans give the president a negative score in his handling of foreign policy. Sarah just mentioned Afghanistan, particularly the chaotic exit there. But in this poll, his handling of foreign policy, a negative score, 34% to 59%. In August, it was 42% approval and 44% more or less disapproving, more or less split on handling of foreign policy. How do you perceive this?
One interesting thing is that Americans in this poll actually think that ending the war with Afghanistan was the right thing to do by a huge margin, 69-24. Even Republicans are slightly above water on this, agreeing that it was the right thing. So, most Americans think that getting out was the right call. Now, they don't approve of the way, the ugly way that the withdrawal was handled. And so in that respect, I think, as we move farther away from the event and these images, these horrible images of people, clinging to planes and mobbing the airport and obviously the suicide bombings and so forth, as we move away from those images, I think that At least on this particular aspect of foreign policy, it's likely that Biden's approval is going to tick up again, because on the whole, Americans are happy that the U.S. troops are out of the country. I mean, there may be some other unforeseen international repercussions. So, for example, in China, the Chinese media is quite gleeful about this withdrawal, this ugly withdrawal, and saying that, for example, it shows that the U.S. doesn't have credibility anymore with its allies. We'll have to see how that shakes out over time. But just, purely on the domestic side, I think on this issue, it's likely that Biden's numbers will improve as we get away from the kind of horror of the withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Sarah, you referred to poll numbers here, Biden's handling of the response to the coronavirus mixed in this poll, 48% approving of his response to the coronavirus, 49% disapproving, compares to August when he received 53% approval compared to 40% disapproval. So Sarah, here again, this is what you were referring to, may have numbers like this may have spurred the administration to take the actions it did last week.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the vaccine mandates at the federal level I expect those numbers will tick back upward, especially among Democrats in the next survey. I just wanted to point out on the Afghanistan front that I was showing this to my class, that if you take the amount of money that we spent in Afghanistan and Iraq and the war, the war on terror wars, we spent the equivalent of the entire U.S. budget in 2020. So if you think about it that way, all of the money that the U.S. government spends in 1 year was allocated to fighting those conflicts. So I think that's one of the reasons why Americans are in support of pulling out, because the scale of the amount of money that we spent, and then to really not, change the long-term outcome on the ground in Afghanistan, I think is why so many people support the policy overall.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University. If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Ben Kiefer with our two analysts this week. Let's talk about Iowa-centered politics here for a few minutes. On Monday, this was the big news for Iowa. Federal judge blocking a state law that had prohibited schools from requiring mask wearing. The decision means school districts across our state can now issue universal mask requirements, as the CDC recommends, as long as this temporary order is in place. And as a result, kids returning to schools in some districts across Iowa today will be required to wear masks. I'm sure a point of discussion around many breakfast tables this morning. But again, in line with CDC guidelines, not only that, the American Academy of Pediatrics said universal masking is a key to keeping schools safe. So it lines up with the science here. At least one school district acted immediately on Monday, hours after the ruling was made, the Des Moines Public Schools, announcing all students, staff, visitors must wear masks starting today. Others following suit, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, as you saw, West Burlington School District. No doubt mask mandates will be made in other school districts as school boards hold their votes on this. Jonathan, how does this court ruling change the political equation here in Iowa? We don't know how long the governor's appeal will take to work its way through the courts.
That's right. Or, for instance, an appellate court may, take the stay off that this district court judge has imposed, and then school districts will once again be banned from having masks. I mean, one interesting thing about how this will play out is that what we're likely to see is that, ironically, those districts that have the highest vaccination rates, probably in the lowest caseloads, places like Des Moines or Iowa City or Ames, are probably going to impose mask mandates first, right? Des Moines has already done so. Those sort of more rural counties that are experiencing heavier caseloads for various political reasons, I think, are going to be more unlikely to impose mask mandates. In a certain sense, this the stay of this law, at least in theory, should be something that Republicans cheer. Obviously, they're the ones who passed the law in the first place and signed by Governor Reynolds. But what it's doing is it's returning power to make local rulings up to local school boards. Which, again, in theory, returning power to local government is something that the GOP has historically been for. So I think it'll be hard to see how this – I don't know exactly how the politics will play out in Iowa. I suppose we'll have to see.
our Governor Reynolds certainly not cheering this ruling, saying it's contrary to the decision made by the Republican-controlled Iowa legislature to leave the choice of whether children wear masks up to parents. Let's listen to Governor Reynolds in a press conference September 2nd, standing by her decision in signing this mask mandate ban into law.
It's a law in Iowa. I believe parents can visit with their doctors, and then they will make an informed decision on what's the best thing for their child. And that's where I believe that it needs to stay.
What do you think about Jonathan's thought there, Sarah, that this doesn't match up with traditional Republican slogans of, well, the local people know best how keep government off our back. Let's let our municipalities, our local authorities decide what's best.
Well, I was cynically thinking that the GOP in Iowa also favors local government making policy, except when it comes to minimum wages at the county level.
Right.
So that's another area.
Or conducting elections.
Yes. I think the reality is that the rhetoric of getting the governments off our back and the actual, you know, their policies are just not always in accord with that, you know, the sort of Reagan era, you know, divided government and allowing local governments to have authorities. If you look at the CDC data among children, the cases of COVID in the U.S. right now, I think it's like 23% of the cases are among children. And there's been, I think, 400 deaths from COVID among children. And those numbers are rising because the Delta variant is much more deadly among the younger population. And so I think, I personally think it would be a good idea for schools to protect, you know, schools and parents and teachers to be more protected. Of course, I'm teaching at an institution that does not have a mask mandate. So I'm walking into the classroom myself amidst a lot of students not making choices to mask up in the classroom. So, right. It puts people like me in a tough situation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to be clear, that's a good point you raise. This ruling by the federal judge only applies to mask mandates issued by Iowa's school districts, local governments, cities, counties. They are still banned by law from issuing mask mandates. And in your cases, most personally, the law does not apply to the three public universities governed by the Iowa Board of Regents. Well, let's talk a little bit about the special session that's been scheduled now. The Iowa Supreme Court announced yesterday it'll allow state lawmakers to proceed with voting on new boundaries for legislative and congressional districts. Governor Reynolds has scheduled a special legislative session to begin October 5th. If we remember, the release of the U.S. Census data once every 10 years, delayed by the pandemic this year, leaving the state unable to approve new political maps in the time for the deadline set by the Iowa Constitution. And missing that deadline gave the authority for redistricting to the Iowa Supreme Court, which made its announcement felt on Monday. Jonathan, does this mean necessarily that the redistricting process will play out like it has in the past few decades? We want to remember Iowa is held up as a nonpartisan model for redistricting.
That's right. The Nonpartisan Legislative Service Agency draws the first set of maps, and then there's some debate around that. My hope is that it'll play out as it has since 1980, right? That this is a nonpartisan process. Obviously, other states are decided purely by partisan politics in the state legislature, and then the fights can get very ugly. It sort of remains to be seen what the Iowa GOP will do this year. They, of course, control the levers of power here, the governorship and a majority in both the state house and the Senate. And so, if they want to inject more partisanship into this and the way other states have done that, only, I suppose, norms and tradition are preventing a certain amount of that. So hopefully we'll be able to keep the nonpartisan tradition that we've had before. I mean, unfortunately, in recent years, the Supreme Court has greenlighted more aggressive gerrymandering around the country. And I guess we can all hope that doesn't spill over here.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, I'm wondering what you know about the, let's just call them guardrails, to keep this a nonpartisan redistricting process. Are they sufficient when one party has unified control of all the levers of government in Des Moines?
Well, there's a few things about our process that help protect against gerrymandering, and it has to do with the way, sort of the rules about how the districts have to be drawn. So the congressional districts have to be contiguous, so all of the counties would have to be, you know, touching each other in terms of their land contiguity. They also, you can't break up counties in those districts, and they have to be compact in terms of, you know, like the, in terms of the size of the district. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, the contiguity rule and the not being able to break up counties makes it harder given just the, you know, the geographic layout of where people live in Iowa. It would be harder to gerrymander the districts under the, under those rules.
Okay, so the old deadline, no longer September 15th, that would be today. It's December 1st, the new deadline. Legislature going to follow this process identified in Iowa code. The Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency says it will release a first set of maps tomorrow, I believe. Public hearings to follow next week. Then lawmakers will convene in October to approve or reject the proposed maps. I think there's a series of you know, if the first set is rejected, what happens then, and so forth. So this is something we're going to keep on the front burner with Iowa Public Radio News and in our talk shows to discuss as well. I wanted to ask you a little bit about going back to congressional politics, Jonathan and Sarah. On Monday, we saw the House Democrats unveiled this sweeping proposal for tax hikes on big corporations and the wealthy. This is to fund President Biden's $3.5 trillion rebuilding social policy bill. It would revert the top tax rate to nearly 40% on individuals who earn more than $400,000. That'd be $450,000 for couples. There would be a 3% tax on the wealthier Americans and adjusted income beyond $5 million a year. Jonathan, business anti-tax groups, to be sure, will object, are objecting. But what about the majority of Americans who do not earn anywhere near $400,000 would be completely unaffected by these tax hikes?
That's right. I mean, if you look at opinion polling over the decades and ask Americans about whether or not they'd like to see, for example, higher rates on wealthier Americans, overwhelmingly people say that they would. But obviously, you know, in the United States in general, we have a perception that Republicans cut taxes and Democrats raise them. But if you sort of pull aside the partisan labels, a steeply progressive tax plan is more popular than not. But, of course, messaging, this being politics, you know, the sort of objective reality is less relevant than the messaging around this. And, of course, a plan like this allows Republicans at the national level and at the state level to point to their Democratic opponents as, you know, tax and spend liberals and all of this sort of slogans that we've been hearing for many years, even if the underlying policies taken one by one are actually quite popular. Whether or not this is going to happen politically will be interesting to see. Of course, the Democrats only control the Senate by the narrowest of margins, relying on some very conservative Democrats like West Virginia's Joe Manchin, who is going to be a key arbiter for whether or not this goes through. Certainly, if it goes up as regular legislation, I cannot imagine that all these tax increases are going to survive a Republican filibuster. But the Democrats have the ability to use something called reconciliation, which is a technical process that related to budget matters that allows a simple majority to happen on particular legislation. I don't know. We'll have to see how this plays out, whether reconciliation is used or not. Mm-hmm. Even if it is, you have to get very conservative Democrats on board with this. And so the tax plan is not going to happen as it was originally proposed, right? We don't know what the final product is going to be, but it's not going to be as grand as this.
Yeah. Sarah, let's talk a little bit about the messaging that Jonathan just commented on. Democrats pushing for these tax hikes, traditionally or in recent political history, a political third rail to talk about raising taxes. Or has that changed?
Well, not really. I mean, I think the parties are still messaging very, you know, like they have in the past. But the if you look back over the last few decades, you know, typically Republican presidents run up deficits and debt, and then Democratic presidents come in and bring that down a little bit. And so now, right under Trump, we saw a massive increase again of the deficit. So Democrats, yeah, have used taxation as one strategy to try to bring those deficits down. Of course, you know, Biden is also playing a little bit of the GOP card here, where he's has these like massive relief bills, right, without really having a clear plan up front in terms of how we're going to pay for them. So, but those policies they're popular, I think, if you look at the surveys on them, and they've reduced child poverty in this country already to a noticeable difference. So, you know, when you start sending people $500 a month for every child, you know, those kind of spending policies, you know, make people more receptive to having the government help them, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, I mean, the people who make over $400,000 a year control by far the vast majority of wealth in this country. So it makes sense that the taxation, you know, candidates like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and others, you know, were campaigning on exactly this kind of approach.
Mm-hmm. What are your predictions, Sarah? Please start on this, the fate of this larger package, not the hard infrastructure package that is also in the works, but this much larger. It's been called the $3.5 trillion one, but it's doubtful whether that number will stay attached to it. Sarah, what are you placing the chances of it passing in some form on this September 15th?
I don't know. I'm skeptical, I guess.
Okay. But, Jonathan, but will you give it a different rating or a different chances than skeptical?
I'm not an expert on Congress, though.
Okay. You got your out there. Okay, good.
I certainly am also not an expert on Congress, but I think something's going to come out of it. I think, you know, I mean, the two people in America that really need to be convinced about this are Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona, Democratic senator, and Joe Manchin, Democratic senator of West Virginia. And, you know, something is going to be crafted, I think, that appeals to them both, some sort of grand bargain. I predict that something will get passed by reconciliation. I don't know what it'll look like, but that's my prediction.
Okay, thank you very much. And we'll include more of your expertise in foreign policy next time we invite you both on. Sarah Mitchell and Jonathan Hasid, thank you so much for weighing in on these important issues today.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River, produced today by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.